You know, it's going to be a continuation of my talk last night. And I was sharing with you the experience that I made, God gave me the grace of making, of discovering my limitations, my weaknesses, my incapacity to communicate His truth, and nevertheless using me as a means of bringing some of His beloved sheep into the fold. And the greatness of it is that you realize you cannot do it. You are forced on your knees, and then He takes over and helps you. I have some 21 God children, and very many of them are ex-students who found their way into the church. Now, of course, this made me conscious of the fact that one of the most important things in life is education. And there, I'm extremely sad to say that for the last 40 years, very many members of the church that are supposed to be educators have tragically failed in their duty to communicate truth. Once again, let me go back to the rampant totalitarianism of relativism, in which it is assumed by definition as a sort of basic principle of democracy that to claim that truth is objective is to impose your ideas upon others and to be arrogant. There are two things that I'm going to try to do this afternoon. And the first one is going to be a defense of what we call natural law. Most of us realize that for the last 40 or 50 years, once again, there has been a systematic attack on the notion of natural law, namely that man's mind is capable of distinguishing good and evil, that there's an inner voice speaking to us and telling us that certain things are evil and should not be done. You must recall, those of you that are elderly, that when Clarence Thomas was trying to be appointed to the Supreme Court, he was constantly attacked because he defended the notion of natural law. What I'm going to do first, and this is going to be the first part of my talk, is to refer to some of the amazing ideas that Plato has developed in his two large educational works, The Republic and The Laws. And I'm going to try to show that this man who was a pagan, that is to say someone who has not benefited of the incredible gift of the Judeo-Christian revelation, nevertheless was so truth-loving and truth-centered that he gave us some insights that we can completely and totally absorb into Catholic education. What I'm going to tell you is simply an historical reference to some of the amazing statements that he made about the importance of education. He keeps stressing that one of the most important things in human life is the task of educating. That is a future of a country, that is a future of the family, that is a future of society. And he claims, and this is something that I would like to insist upon, that man is worth educating. You don't try to educate a dog and a cat, you train them, but you don't try to educate them. In the case of education, it presupposes that there is a being of great worth who is worthy to be educated. Basically, he tells us, what is the purpose of education? I quote, to make a masterpiece out of man. Now, you recall that the Greeks were extraordinarily artistic. If you go to Athens, you still notice the greatness of their artistic productivity. And the question was that it was not enough to make statues of marble that were admirable in beauty and proportion. The question was to chisel man so that he would also become a masterpiece. Simultaneously, Plato is conscious of the fact that it is an extraordinarily difficult task. And why is it so difficult? Great things, he says, are never easy. If you try to accomplish anything in life, you can be absolutely convinced that you're going to encounter with difficulties, obstacles, and sometimes coming from people that are supposed to help and support you. This has been admirably developed by my dear friend, Reverend Father Groeschel, in one of his best books, Rising from Darkness. We're going to see that Plato was aiming at making a masterpiece out of man. Now, in order to do so, you must have a purpose, you must have an aim. What are you trying to achieve? And I'm going to give you six examples that Plato quotes explicitly in either one of the two great works that I've mentioned. He says, first of all, in order to know what we should try to achieve, we have to contemplate the harmonious order of the cosmos. The cosmos is so admirable in its beauty, in its harmony, in its organization. You know, you can look at a star-studded sky. You can look at the beauty of nature. You can be at the greatness of the sea. And you realize there is some magnificent order. Now, this order is surprisingly enough not to be found in man. There is a great deal of disorder in him, and it is precisely the purpose of education to try to introduce harmony in this disharmony. The second amazing statement that Plato makes, and every time I turn back to it, I'm more impressed by the depth of his insights as a pagan. He mentions, that is to say, very early in the Republic, which is a relatively early work, that man is a split being. Man is not unified. There are good things in him, and there are things that are very bad. He can be truth-loving, and he can be truth-hating. He can be generous, and the next moment he can be stingy. Now, what should with education try to achieve? To unify man in the good. All of us, to a certain extent, are split personalities. You know, you see that in very many people that you admire. You see some very good traits, very remarkable traits, and the next moment you discover flaws, and you just say, how is it possible that in one and the same being you find these contradictions? Now, the purpose of education is to help a child to become unified, but unified in the good. And it is only the good that unifies us. Number three, and there you see the deeply religious concern of Plato, a concern which unfortunately is not to be found in Aristotle, because Aristotle developed a tragic idea that even though God produced a world eternity, he doesn't know that we exist, because knowledge of the world would sort of put some imperfection on the divine image. And therefore he cuts man off from God completely, because obviously if God doesn't know that I exist, there's very little sense in religious life, because why am I going to address myself to a being who cannot hear me? He says, what we should try to do in education is to keep as purpose to create a human character that heaven can approve of. Now we're going to translate this in Christian terms very soon. Moreover, I've mentioned a minute ago that Plato says that man is a split personality. But this split is very profound, because for some reason, many of us, and maybe all of us, if we are not healed, sometimes confuse appearance from reality, illusion from what is. And the purpose of education is metanoia, that is to say, to turn around, to turn from darkness to light, to turn from appearance to reality, to turn from error to truth. In other words, what should be achieved in education is to turn, to form the soul, to go from a day that is truly like night into a true day. In other words, the illusion that we live in, illusions which is so furthered in our secular universe, secular society, making us believe that we're going to achieve happiness or whatever it might be through achievement, success, power, and money. All this is a lie. This is an appearance, and we should try to turn to what is true reality. The sixth one, and the last one, which is in some way I consider to be a key to education, is that we should teach a child to love what is lovable and to hate what is hateful. If you can achieve this, the child is on the way to sanity and to holiness. The tragedy in the world in which we live is that we are sort of encouraged to love, to admire, to appreciate, to look up to things which are not worth it, which are sheer illusions. We must hate what is hateful, and we should love what is lovable. Therefore, what deserves to be loved. Something is not lovable because I like it, but I should like it because it is lovable. This is what Plato suggests. But the next moment is going to tell us and remind us how difficult it is to achieve the purpose that he's just giving us. Why? Number one, you know, I give you some of the main ideas. Because most of us, and of course this includes children, do not think that we need help or guidance. We believe that we know best. And you already can see that in little children. When you tell them to do, not to do something, they sort of feel, well, I'm to decide, and I'm going to do and decide what I want to do. But the idea that you need guidance is something that many people forget. What is the whole purpose of monastic life? To submit to guidance, because you realize that you need it. And we all need it desperately, but we are not aware of it. We believe we know best. We believe we can trust our own judgment, even when it is totally erroneous. There's also in all of us, and this is something that Plato stresses emphatically, there is a tremendous immaturity. And you know what is the best symptom of immaturity? To assume that one is mature. Now, you notice that particularly at the time of puberty, when a boy or a girl aged 12 or 13 or 14, as the case might be, suddenly declare, why do I have to follow my parents? I know best. The problem has started. They believe to be mature and they're heading for problems. Because you believe that you're mature, you claim your rights. And simultaneously, you shun responsibilities. Now, if you claim that you have rights, you also have responsibilities. And you will notice in our society, everybody's clamoring for rights, but very few people are likely to accept, to assume responsibility. Another danger, which is to be found in all of us in various degrees, is that we believe we can know everything, whether it is because we are great scientists, it is because we are great scholars, because the innumerable footnotes in what we write, we believe that we know everything. And a sort of new age is to promise that we are going from progress to progress to progress, and one very fine day, in fact, God is going to become God, because the progress that he had achieved in technology for the last 50 years sort of opens up new horizons, which are so amazing that you can see we can conquer the world. The next thing that Plato mentions is, and let me mention once again how crucial and profound it is, coming from a pagan 24 centuries ago. One of the typical signs of immaturity, not to say stupidity, is that every single time we make a mistake, we always assume that it is someone else's fault. You know, as a matter of fact, don't forget this was written 24 centuries ago. Others are to be blamed for our failures, not myself. In our society, your genes, your background, your family, your education, your lack of education, every excuse is good. And I simply say that the modern confiteor is no longer mea culpa. It is tua culpa, tua culpa, tua maxima culpa. It's not man, it's everybody else. Well, I mean, this is something which is all of us. You know, when something happens, the first spontaneous reaction is to say, well, so-and-so is responsible. So-and-so told me. It is my brother, it is my sister, it's my father, it's my mother, it's someone else. But we all might find someone who is going to say, well, he's responsible for my mistakes and my failures and my sins. So finally, they are not sins. Basically, we are victims. Don't forget, this was written 24 centuries ago. Plato said one of the greatest obstacles to education is bad examples given by elderly people and immediately copied and followed by young people. For example, 24 centuries ago, free love. Maybe this is something that finds an echo in our society, because everybody seems to be advocating free love, whatever that means. Also the fact that Plato says we live in a society when might is considered to be right. If you have power, you exercise it for your own advantage. The fact that lies are quite acceptable under certain circumstances. And surprisingly enough, every time that you lie, you can justify. See, in my case, it was justified. Moreover, Plato warns us of the danger of novelties in dancing and in music. Plato understood very, very profoundly that so-called entertainments can contain a subtle poison that can actually lead to the death of the soul. He mentions that in music, there can be a certain type of rhythm. Maybe he's alluding to rock and roll, long before it was born, which sort of frees in us what is low, what is despicable, and what is immoral. He condemns immoral art, that is to say, one that actually appeals to our concupiscence and to our lust. He makes us conscious of the fact that literature can be extremely dangerous and that a child should be freed from reading things which are going to have an adverse effect on the development of his soul. He said, and therefore we have to keep away from, quotes, poisonous weeds, unquote. And then all the beauty, which is basically to be found in the human soul, will develop and flower. He says, if you expose yourself to true beauty, I quote, like breath bearing health from happy regions, some influence from noble works constantly falls upon the ear and eye from childhood upward and imperceptibly draws them into sympathy and harmony with what is true beauty. And he claimed, if a child is fed in true beauty as a child, he will have a norm and then later on instinctively reject what is ugly. Therefore, he insists upon the importance of true beauty in education. Simultaneously, he warns us that, surprisingly enough, as I said a moment ago, but man is not unified. In one of his most powerful dialogues called Phaedrus, Plato speaks of the tragic case of a charioteer who has two horses. One of them is obedient, and the other one keeps kicking and biting. And the charioteer has a most difficult time trying to bring them into harmony, because whereas one horse is obedient, the other one always pulls in the false direction. This is something which is to be found in all of us. Our human soul is a battlefield between good and evil. And sorry to say, and this is Plato mentioned 24 centuries ago, unfortunately, the human heart is rebellious. There's something in us that says no. There is a real wickedness in the human heart that must be conquered And if it is not conquered, it's going to overpower us. Unfortunately, there's something in us which is unwilling to listen to the truth. For some reason, all of us dread truth. We dread it. We run away from it because the moment that you know it, you have to submit to it. This is why it is so difficult to know oneself. All of us are geniuses at detecting faults in others. But why is it so difficult to know our own faults? Because it's so painful. Because it is so humiliating. To say of another person is arrogant. That's very simple. But to say that there's arrogance in myself, that is painful. Now this is something that Plato has seen so clearly. And this is why he said we are not willing to listen to the truth. And as a matter of fact, man tends to prefer himself to the truth. Now, I claim that there's not a single word of what I have read to do which cannot be completely and totally incorporated in Catholic education. You know, this is why let us remember that all the fathers of the Church were using much of Platonism as a foundation for their theology. St. Augustine says, of all the pagan philosophers, Plato is the greatest because he was the one most open and most ready to accept truth. And I cannot help but believe that on his deathbed, this very noble pagan was given a chance of saying yes to Christ. I cannot quite conceive like Dante that he's going to be put in limbo because he lived prior to the revelation of Christ. I believe in God's infinite love and mercy, and someone who has contributed so much to wisdom and to the love of truth, certainly someone that we can look forward to meeting in heaven. Now, let me make a short interlude. What has Plato's ideas of education taught us? The greatness of man, the nobility of man, and the weakness and imperfection of man. The absolute necessity to be educated. Because without education, almost inevitably, man is going to fall into error. Let us compare for one moment the type of education that Plato advocated in Greece 24 centuries ago and the state of our education today. I spent 37 years at the City University. I'm a veteran in the classroom, and I can only assure you that what I've seen again and again is to trample on all the basic, beautiful ideas that Plato has given us. First of all, what is very striking in the Platonic idea is that even though man's body is to be trained and educated, man must also be trained to seek and pursue truth. And most important, man must strive to know what matters most, or knowledge of God. In other words, there's a very clear hierarchy. There are physical things, there are intellectual things, but what matters most is man's pursuit. Who is God? And how does man relate to him? What is typical of secular education, and I say this with tears in my eyes, in most Catholic colleges, schools, and universities nowadays, is that this is totally forgotten, totally pushed aside. I can say for the last 14, 50 years, Catholic children have been deprived of authentic Catholic teaching. They know nothing about it. They've been deprived and they've been betrayed. Now, this is a very sad question that I'm not going to address, but you are perfectly aware that it is, unfortunately, a fact. Now, suppose that you take the situation in a secular place like Hunter, or you take most American universities. What are the top priorities? Two things, sports and making money. And I recall one of the last meetings that I attended in Hunter College, that one of the leading deans or whatever he said, the whole purpose of education is to train a child to make a fast buck. This is a betrayal of man and of the dignity of his mission. You know, we become machines to produce money, and what for? Then you all know the craze, not only in the United States, but all over the world, for sports. Sports people are heroes. They're placed on top of our scale. If someone is a champion, it can be golf, it can be baseball, these are heroes. Well, you know, I have nothing against sport, and I'm convinced that it has a legitimate role to play. But to place it in front, on top of the scale, is a tragedy and a betrayal of the dignity of man. As to the question of making money, what is typical of the world in which we live, that you can have quiz children of 16, 17, 18 that are geniuses at computer, but don't ask them whether they have a soul. Don't ask them whether there is a God. Don't ask them what is the purpose of human life. They have no clue because they haven't been told. And this is why we live in a society which is so sick. We live in a society threatened by despair. You know, this was so profoundly and movingly exposed by Roy Sherman this morning, someone who is so successful, someone who is so talented, someone who achieved whatever he wanted to do and was facing despair because his life had no meaning. That is the situation of the overwhelming majority of our children today. They have been betrayed. And unless we turn around in metanoia and realize that unless education is giving back its real meaning and purpose, that is to show that there is a clear hierarchy. What is most is our knowledge of God and the meaning of human life and the immortality of the soul. The intellectual life is all important because it is related to truth. And the other things play a role, but should play a secondary and minor role. Now, I cannot be negative enough about the state of our contemporary education, and I beg and urge each and every one of you who has a chance to try to remedy it in the field of your possibilities. This is where we have to start. Otherwise, I can only say, rich as we are doomed to failure. We are doomed to being overcome. I happen to be someone who has a great interest in history ever since I was a little girl. And when you study the history of Athens, this glorious, magnificent culture, 5th century Athens was a sort of peak of culture. And then to see the decadence, and Plato says this decadence comes because we have lost our sense of reverence. You study the history of Rome. Rome conquered great parts of the world. Rome was all powerful. You know, magnificent buildings, incredible productivity from every point of view. And they were defeated by barbarians who had only picks and stocks. Why? Because of the incredible moral decadence. Now, we have realized that this is a tragic situation that we are facing today. And I mean, as I've devoted my life to education, I can only tell you the task is urgent. We are running out of time. And unless we turn around completely and totally, I don't think we have every reason or any reason to be optimistic about the future of the West. Now, what is the difference between the Platonic education and Catholic education? Let me repeat. It seems to me that we can say every single word pronounced by Plato can be incorporated in Catholic education. Each one of them is valid. Each one of them is true. Each one of them is a challenge to live up to our duty to educate our children. But these, of course, enormous differences. And the enormous difference is between pagan culture and Catholic revelation. Great as Plato was, it did not benefit from the Judeo-Christian revelation. There are certain things that were hidden from his side, not because of his fault, because I'm convinced that he was open to it, but because through some mysterious ways of God, he was not given a chance of seeing certain things. He certainly was willing, but it was not given to him, because grace is given by God to whom he pleases, when he pleases, and because he pleases. Now, the first thing that I would like to underline is that the Platonic hierarchy of values, putting physical things at the bottom, intellectual things, and then on the very top, the most crucial importance, man's religious education, is totally endorsed in Roman Catholicism. But there are a few very crucial differences that I would like to underline. The first one is that there's an abyss between the Platonic conception of God and the Judeo-Christian revelation, culminating in the incarnation of the second person of the Holy Trinity, our blessed Lord Christ. The Platonic idea of God was vague, just showing that man is capable of knowing that there is some divinity. But to know the nature of this divinity is very difficult, if not impossible, for someone who is not held by revelation. And for this reason, you can say Plato keeps oscillating between saying the gods, and then all of a sudden he says God. Now, as I'm a great lover of Plato, always trying to interpret things as positively as I can, and I say when he says the gods, he speaks as a Greek. When he says God, he speaks as a philosopher. Because if you use your mind properly, you can understand that to have a multiplicity of God is a contradiction. It's something which is not possible. So he keeps oscillating between the two. But just to show you how imperfect his concept of God is, I'm going to point to one weakness, and there are very many of them. It is extremely interesting that according to Plato, if I commit an evil deed, for example, I murder someone, and then I die, and then I find myself in this other world, because Plato was absolutely convinced of the immortality of the human soul. You know, it's not that he succeeded in proving it, but better than prove, he was so profoundly convinced of it, you know, even though he had no rational proof that was actually satisfactory. And then you come to this other world, and you come face to face with the person that you have murdered. And now there's a confrontation. And the question is he or is he not willing to forgive you? Suppose that he's unwilling to forgive you. Then as a punishment, you'll have to go through a huge wheel of 3,000 years. It's not very clear what happens to you, but somehow you're exiled. And you make this whole enormous pilgrimage. And after 3,000 years, once again, you confront the person that you have murdered. And if he refuses to forgive you, you go all around, and this can go on forever. If, on the contrary, he forgives you, then you come to some sort of, can we say, Greek paradise. It's all very vague, and Plato is wise enough not to be specific about things that we cannot know with absolute certainty. You see the abyss between this and the Judeo-Christian view. Plato has a keen sense of moral evil. He cannot possibly have a sense of sin. If you read the 50th Psalm of David, he said, "It is against you alone that I have sinned." The moment that you say sin, you say an offense of God. Now, obviously, if I murder another person, I do this person a great harm. But the sin is against God. The evil is against the person that has been murdered. But God is offended every single time that I commit a sin. Primarily, sin is against him. This is something that Plato could not see. And this is when you find yourself in the amazing situation that if you depend upon human forgiveness, you can be driven to despair, because it might be that eternally you'll go around this wheel. Whereas in the Judeo-Christian tradition, if you repent, if you go on your knees And you say like David, have mercy on me, Lord. Have mercy. I'm a sinner. You can heal me. Help me. You know that God never refuses forgiveness. This is something that Plato has not perceived. There's another difference, which I believe deserves. You see, Plato was a great truth lover. There's an incredible closeness between Socrates and Plato, to such an extent that in the very early dialogues, you know, both of them seem to be so mixed that you can say in some way Plato was endorsing all the basic insights of Socrates. Socrates said a couple of things that were amazing. At one particular point in a dialogue, because most Platonic, you know, Platonic writings are mostly dialogues, which makes it so lively, that one particular person says to Socrates, Socrates, I agree with you. And Socrates cut him short and say, don't agree with Socrates, agree with the truth. And if Socrates says something which is true, agree with it because it is true, not it is because it comes from Socrates. So I claim that every single truth that you find in the admirable Catholic literature, you know, you take St. Augustine, you take St. Anselm, St. Thomas, St. Bonaventure, don't quote with English, and so forth and so on. You're going to find plenty of truth. But is this wrong to attribute it to the person? The person formulates it. But truth always comes from God through him. You know, this is one of the very beautiful things that my husband said shortly before his death. He said, you know, I've been trying to shed greater light on some Catholic truth. And if you find anything in my manuscripts which is not in total agreement with the teaching of the church, burn it. In other words, his aim was just to transmit what God has given us. I'm going to formulate it this very simply. A Greek could love truth. But we as Christians, as Catholics, know that there's one person who is not only giving us truth, he is the truth. And this is Christ alone. You can study the history of any religion that you please. No one ever dare say, I am the truth, the way and the life. Now, this, of course, is a claim which is so tremendous that if Christ is not God, he's the greatest liar that ever lived. He dare say so. And he said so because it was so. You're not going to find this in Buddha. You're not going to find this in Krishna. You're not going to find this in Mahomet. You're not going to find it in anybody else. He was the only one who says, I am the truth. Now, do you understand? This elevates man's intellectual life to such an unbelievable level, because basically what we should try to do in education is to teach a child to love the truth, a truth who is a person, not a statement, not a logical proposition, but a person. Now, this is, of course, is inevitably linked to humility. And my husband said repeatedly, and this made a great impression upon me, the greatest mistakes that have been made in the history of philosophy were made by extremely intelligent people. My friend Roy Sherman once said to me, you know, I think that the level of IQ is very high in hell. And it's, of course, perfectly right. The greatest mistakes have been made by extremely intelligent people who lacked humility. Why is St. Augustine so great? Why are these great saints so overwhelming? Because with all their knowledge, all their wisdom, all the treasures that they have given us, they were humble and know that all truth comes from God. And all that you can do is to be on your knees and to receive it gratefully. You know, believe me, universities are not places when you learn humility. As a matter of fact, you're going to see that everyone is blowing himself and try to make Demes believe that he's smarter than his colleagues. The rivalry, the bickering that exists between university professors is something not to be described. I know that Wall Street is bad. I claim that universities are worse. Because in Wall Street, everybody is fighting for money. You have your dagger and the other one has his dagger. But in university, there is so much lying as if it was truly the pursuit of wisdom and of truth. Now, this leads me to something which is of crucial importance and is going to lead me to a topic which I have very particularly at heart. You know, all of us have certain hobbies, and almost inevitably, you know, I'm going to put it in my talks because I'm so much concerned about them. What Christianity teaches us is that important as intelligence is, crucial as it is to develop our talents, crucial as it is to try to develop and deepen our knowledge of truth, there's something which is greater, and this is love. And love, when I say by love, I don't mean lust. I don't mean sexual craving. I mean a response to the value of a being that deserves of love. And of course, the one who deserves it most is God himself. And this is why I'm absolutely convinced that it's only by loving God that we can love our neighbor. Because by ourselves, we are so incapable of truly loving that ultimate love is always love to partake of God's love for another person, this sort of triangular relationship. And this leads me to one particular facet of Catholic education that I happen to be tremendously concerned with, for particular reasons. You know that for the last 20 or 30 years, the Church has suffered from all sorts of great trials and difficulties. I'm personally convinced that we are traversing one of the most tragic and difficult periods in the history of the Church. And I'm going to back it up by saying that if you read St. Paul, he announces that we are heading towards what he calls the great apostasy. The great apostasy, not speaking of the past, he's not speaking of the innumerable sins committed by Catholics or by Christians or whatever it might be in the past. He's speaking about the future. And what is a great apostasy? When the faith will be trampled upon and rejected by millions. And the tragedies that have taken place in the Church in the course of the last 40, 50 years. The betrayal of so many priests who have received the most incredible dignity that has been given to a human being. And then betraying their mission, betraying their function, falling into all sorts of shameful of immoralities. And this not one or two, but very many of them. Sometimes you marvel about the fact why it's not something to be done about it. I mean, after all, it seems to me that there are millions of Catholics that are the victims of priests that are unorthodox or not leading a life, which is worthy of the priesthood, which is betraying it. Now, it seems to me that this crisis is so serious. And it's taking one particular form, which is, happens to be my hobby. You know, as I said, everybody has a hobby. And for the last 20 or 25 years, my hobby has been to fight feminism. And so I'm sorry to say, if you heard it before, I apologize. But from time to time, I just have to repeat it because it is so very much in my heart and in my thoughts. What is basically feminism? Now, if you mean to say that women have often been abused by men. This is something that cannot be denied. You know, it is always so, since original sin, that the stronger is likely to abuse of the one who is weaker. But this is not only true of the relationship between men and women. It is also true of the way we treat minorities, of the way that we treat people that are untalented, to treat that we people that are ugly, treat the people that we consider to be stupid, people that we consider to be in some way inferior. And for some reason, we always believe that we are the superior one. Therefore, I don't deny that abuses have taken place, are taking place, and will always take place, because as long as man is not converted, there's always a possibility of abuse on someone with a stronger position. This is something which is not to be denied. You know, as I told you yesterday, I was applying in 6 or 7 Catholic colleges, and I was turned down because I was only a woman. Now, sorry to say that I'm very proud to be only a woman. You know, as a matter of fact, I'm quite used to it because I've been one for a long, long time, and one gets used to things like that. Now, at any rate, one thing is absolutely certain: to be humiliated, to be rejected, to be looked down upon as inferior is subjectively not pleasant. But if you try to be a follower of Christ and you read Isaiah, there he is a man of sorrow who was rejected and buffeted and spat upon and ridiculed. And all of a sudden you understand that you're receiving the very special gift of being treated your Lord Savior. He was innocent. We deserve it. So how can you possibly revolt and become bitter? So I see one of the amazing things which has taken place in the church, and I let me stress very particularly, the Roman Catholic Church is the beauty of the role assigned to women. You know, this is why I wrote this little book called The Privilege of Being a Woman. You know, I hope that sooner or later a man is going to take up the challenge and write The Privilege of Being a Man, which you can also write, because there are certain things assigned to the male sex which are very, very beautiful and should be highlighted. Now, the privilege of being a woman is, to my mind, the privilege of sharing in the biological nature of the most beautiful of all creatures, Mary, the Mother of God. You know, it was said yesterday, was it yesterday in the Gospel, that it was said, blessed is the womb that bore you and the paps that nourished you. And Christ's answer, rather be blessed is the one who keeps the word of God. But of course, what is implied in it is that Mary was the one who kept it most and best. She was the one who was faithful from the very beginning. She was the one who declared herself to be the servant of the world. Now, why is it so important to shed the importance of the role of women in Catholic life and therefore in Catholic education? Because I claim that in God's plan, the woman is given a key position. And the key position is so crucial because it is in the background. You know, naturally speaking, all secular things, all secular accomplishments are in the foreground. Supernaturally speaking, the last will be the first. And if you truly realize the importance granted to Mary, the Mother of God, the most perfect of all creatures, the Mother of God, the one whose womb was a holy temple that sheltered the Son of God for 9 months, that the female body is veiled by a hymen, a veil, symbolizing sacredness. This is why it is so important to inculcate purity to little girls, make them realize the dignity and the beauty of their body. This should not teach them pride. It should teach them humility. It should teach them to realize that one of the greatest blessings in life is to be God's servant. As a matter of fact, in all Tridentine liturgy, it is said, to serve God is to reign. And this is precisely what women worthy of this name understand, that service is an honor. Service is a grace. It's not something which is degrading. It is something that elevates you. I mean, after all, you find it all in the words of the Holy Virgin. I'm the handmaid of the Lord. I'm his servant. That is our glory of men and women. And then be it done to me. Underlying female receptivity. You know, and basically, being creatures, we should always be receptive. Everything comes from God, and nothing comes from us, ourselves. Why am I so unhappy about feminism? Because I claim that being given the key role that women play in the world, in marriage, in the family, in the church, feminism is a poison that threatens marriage. This is why so many of them go to pieces. That destroys the family, and that is simply spreading a cancer in the church. There is nothing more ridiculous than women who claim that they have a right to become priests. I say it is so ridiculous, even though I'm going to make a joke because, you know, having Latin blood from time to time, I've got to make jokes. I cannot help it. No, and what is my joke? I say the day that men can give birth, I'll be the first one to claim that women have a right to become priests. But they have not achieved it and will never achieve it. So at least we have the privilege of giving birth, and that is plenty. Men should also be given something very special, which is precisely to serve God in the priesthood. But you will notice that if you read the Old Testament and the New, it is said very explicitly, God chooses whom he pleases. You know, this is why Korah and the people revolted against Moses when he came down from Mount Sinai and said, we also have a right to be priests, not only the Levites, everybody. And Moses said, stand there, and God will speak. And one moment the earth opened up and swallowed them. If you read the gospel, you're going to see that Christ, when he chose his apostles, he chose whom he pleased. Whom am I to say, to dictate to God, no, look, you're totally unfair, you're terribly undemocratic. I also have a right to become a priest. If he decides that I'm not going to become a priest, this is the last thing that I want. You read the epistle of St. Paul to the Hebrews, in which he says the privilege is given to whom God gives it. Who am I to give it? Now, women have received the incredible privilege of sharing the physical nature of the most privileged of all creatures, Mother of God. And this is what I claim, and this is something that I keep repeating in every single talk that I give. Women are the guardians of purity. And if they truly understand and live this mission, they're going to prevent or protect men from falling into ignoble sins. It all depends the way that you dress, the way that you sit, your body language, the way that you behave. Men are very keen at knowing whether or not the door is open or closed. And if they know that a woman has respect for the dignity and the mystery of her body, they will respect her and the world will go back on track. Why do I hate feminism? Because basically it is a slap in the face of the most holy of all creatures, Mary, the Mother of God. And quite recently, you know, I'm quite old, but it's only very recently that this idea crossed my mind. I was meditating on the beauty of Mary and sweetness of Mary and all her privileges. She was born without original sin. She conceived in her womb the second person of the Holy Trinity. She actually was pregnant with God. She's the one who gave the Savior to the world. She's the one who partook of his passion as no one else has. And all of us, it crossed my old mind, something absolutely amazing. She had another privilege, and a privilege I never thought of until a few weeks ago. She was privileged to change the diapers of the Savior of the world. She did not say to St. Joseph, come and help me. You know, I've done this enough. It's your time that you take over. She understood that it was the most incredible privilege that she had. Now, once you understand this, you understand that it's an incredible privilege to be a woman and to serve. Thank you. Well, don't forget that my husband was the one who trained and inspired me. He should be given some credit too.
Thank you, Dr. Hildebrand.